We're talking now with our first district Senator Jim Woodward. Jim, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate the opportunity.
So our goal here is to do a review of what happened down in the legislature this year. On one hand, it was a history-making session because it was the longest legislative session. And as I understand it, the House actually is just in recess while the Senate adjourned. Is that accurate?
That's correct. It's the first time in Idaho history that two bodies haven't agreed to adjourn sine die or sine die, the Latin phrase for to go to a date indefinite there. So it's a little bit of a different situation. It's provided a few legal questions, but that is the status right now.
Does that mean that the House can call itself back into session?
The House is at recess, and so if House leadership decided to convene again, they could. And with the constitutional requirement that neither body can be gone for more than three days without the consent of the other, that would mean that the Senate would be coming back in also.
Oh, I see. Okay. So we'll just have to, at this point, are there legal questions that the Attorney General's office is looking into?
I think that there is a question a little bit about it's a situation that hasn't occurred before, and so how does it start back up? What forces the other body to come in? Some of the real, probably more technical legal aspects of it, but that is true.
So is it just a matter of waiting to see how things play out? If anything,
well, the concern that I understood was that if there were more federal funding available this year, then the legislature would want to weigh in on how that money is spent. And so what we did in the Joint Finance and Appropriations Committee is put a bill together, Senate Bill 1204, that said that any of the ARPA, that Rescue Plan Act money, is all recognized or cognizable, and so that none of that could be spent through the process outside the legislative appropriation process. That was some of the concern last year, that there was quite a bit of federal money that came in, and it was all run through the non-cognizable funds process instead of through the legislative appropriation process. So the executive branch was making those determinations, and that was the rub with some legislators. But there were legislators involved in that process last year. The governor put together a committee to the CARES Act funds committee that oversaw the spending of that money. So there was legislative input, but not in the normal manner. And so this year, with the ARPA money coming and potentially other if Congress, the U.S. Congress, were to act and spend other money, there was a potential. So we did take care of the concern with Senate Bill 1204 in regards to the ARPA money. And then we also had a letter from the governor saying that if any money did come in outside the ARPA money, that and it needed to be used before the next legislative session, he wrote a letter saying that he would then convene the legislature to appropriate that money, but that still wasn't enough apparently to make some to allay the concerns of some, and that was to my understanding why the House did not adjourn for the year.
Okay, well, that'll be an kind of an ongoing saga here for us to keep an eye on. Overall, do you feel this was a good, productive legislative session? And if you were going to give a grade to the productivity of the legislature this year, what would you give them?
I'll think about that grade here for a moment, but
okay.
I'll say it was a long session, history-making in the length. It was contentious, but maybe those things are to be expected after a once-in-a-100-year event. There was some good that came out of the legislative session this year. We had some of the smaller pieces that came out, vehicle registration, new means of dealers being able to register your vehicle, and that's a day-to-day challenge out at the DMV. And so in the future, there are two things going on. ITD just announced, separate from the legislature, that they have a new electronic registration system set up for If you purchase a vehicle from a dealer, you can go online to register. But then separate from that, what we did in the legislature was authorized a program that's already in place in other states where private vendors can provide that registration system at the dealer also. So that's just one example. We also saw some things like off-highway vehicle restrictions. Right now you can only cross a highway in a side-by-side or a four-wheeler if you have the white plate, the small off-highway vehicle plate. Now you can run 5 miles. So, for example, if someone were coming down from Lightning Creek over in the Hope Clark Fork area, come down Lightning Creek and Clark Fork and then transfer over to Johnson and continue on. So those are some of the things I think that matter to people on a day-to-day basis here living in northern Idaho. We also had, of course, the bigger pieces, the tax policy. We reduced the Idaho state income tax from 6.925% down to 6.5%. It hasn't been that long since we reduced the legislature prior to my time, reduced it from 7.4%. So we're down almost a full percentage on Idaho income tax in the last decade. And
that was because the state's doing pretty well financially, I take it.
There's a large amount of revenue coming into the state. The primary revenue sources for the state of Idaho are income tax and sales tax. Income tax and sales tax are affected by economic activity, and then also what we've seen this year, and what I believe is the large amount of federal money that's come in, which is really, that's money on our credit card, our national credit card. So we shouldn't look or ignore that. That money has to be paid back. But when somebody receives a $1,200 stimulus check and spends it, 6% of that goes into the Idaho State General Fund. Mm-hmm. And so the extra money that's come in from stimulus checks and money to local units of government and all these different programs, we saw in the last fiscal year, we saw $8 billion of additional money from outside of Idaho come in just due to federal programs. And like I said, that's money that we're borrowing from ourselves, so I'm not sure. Some of it's been well used and maybe some of it hasn't. And we expect to see another $5 billion in the next, this fiscal year is coming up. So that has certainly had an effect. And so that is masking potentially, I think, the true economic activity, just because that's outside money that's not where we would normally see income tax and sales tax grow as we had more people in the state and more economic activity. This is just money being injected.
Might be kind of a one-time thing, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's exactly it. So the income tax reduction from 6.9% to 6.5% is ongoing. There's also going to be an income tax rebate for anybody who paid income tax in Idaho in 2019 is going to receive 9% rebate coming back. So you can expect to see that check in the mail at some point here. So that was tax policy, income tax policy. We also had a rather large bill that had quite a few components in it: property taxes, circuit breaker exemption, homeowners exemption, and business personal property. So House Bill 389, the homeowner's exemption was raised from $100,000 to $125,000. That's a great start at getting that adjusted back to an appropriate level. I believe the original intention on the homeowners, as you can see in the code, it's written, it's $100,000 or up to 50%. And so that $100,000 certainly is for the median home in most of Idaho is not near 50%. So making that adjustment up, though, that is a 25% increase, and that's a big step to head in the way of getting homeowners exemption back to the relative percentage that it used to be. Circuit breaker program, that's elderly, lower income, that the maximum property tax liability reduction currently is $1,320. So, and that's being changed to $1,500. So a little bit more property tax relief for elderly low income. But the one stipulation added to the circuit breaker program this year is eligibility for the program is also now based on the value of your home. And so if the value of your home is more than 125% of the median assessed value, then you're not eligible for the program.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And then important to some of our local businesses here on business personal property, right now the first $100,000 of business personal property is exempt, and that is being raised to $250,000. So if a restaurant has other equipment, or a body shop, collision shop has a certain amount of equipment inside, the first $250,000 will be exempt. And then for loggers and contractors up here, the transient business personal properties, piece of logging equipment or a piece of construction equipment, all of that will come off the business personal property tax rolls.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like generally positive news for taxpayers.
Yes.
On these various bills, yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. Other legislation that you'd like to mention?
Oh, another big piece is the transportation bill. We've known for some time now that we're not putting enough money into our road system. The study 10 years ago under Governor Otter said that we were probably short about $250 million per year. And that study was conducted again this past year, and even though we've made additions to the funding over the last 10 years, we're still at about the same level, showing around probably $240 million a year that we should be putting into the transportation system just to maintain it. And because the system's gotten bigger, and so as we've added more money, we've kind of kept up with that, but we still have a deficit in what we're spending. To try and help that along, this year we dedicated $80 million per year out of the sales tax money straight to the transportation program. And by peeling that money off before the appropriation process and dedicating it to the transportation, we can make bond payments. So that $80 million per year that we've committed allows $1.5 or $1.6 billion worth of new construction to happen here in the next 5 to 6 years. So we should see some great projects coming in around the state that bonding program will allow. We also, when we talked about, you made the comment about the amount of money that the state has right now, the one-time funds. We had about $600 million of money this year that was in the state. And so we utilized that money in a couple of different ways. One, we put additional money in the rainy day fund. We're still not up to where we were in 2008, 2007 prior to that recession. So we're trying to restore those rainy day funds. We all utilized some of that $600 million for this 9% income tax rebate. And then we also took $126 million and put it toward transportation in the form of different one-time projects around the state, of which we're going to benefit here. That's where the money is coming from for the improvements at the south end of the Long Bridge, which we should see a little bit of this year. They're in design right now, and then we'll see a second phase of improvements at the Bottle Bay to Lakeshore intersection south of Sandpoint here in the next year and a half or 2 years.
Where it's so difficult for traffic coming out of Lakeshore to get onto the highway, yeah.
That's right.
Okay. Well, can I ask about a couple of specific bills? One being Senate Bill 1110, which raised the threshold for signatures required to get citizen initiatives on the ballot. It raised it from 6% generally statewide to 6% in each county, I believe, right? And that was watched by a lot of people here because it relates to work that Reclaim Idaho has been doing, a group that has local roots. And the question here would be, well, first of all, for folks that don't know it, that did pass, and it was signed by the governor. What was your take on that bill, and how did you come down on it?
Well, Senate Bill 1110 does change the signature requirements, as you said. When the initiative process initially in Idaho required collection of signatures from 6% of registered voters, and so we have that's roughly 60,000 signatures. And then at some point that was changed from 6% to 6% in 18 of the 35 districts. And that's where we are now, but the law has changed from with Senate Bill 1110 to you have to collect 6% in each of the 35 districts of the state. We have 35 legislative districts, and by changing that requirement, the intent was that all count or all districts be involved so that everybody have a say. But I still view this as it's a hurdle to put it on the ballot, at which point everybody has a say when we vote on it on the ballot. The petition process is to put it on the ballot. And so I think that going to a full 35 districts becomes a little bit onerous when it's just the hurdle to put it on the public ballot. But the other side of that argument is that if you only have to collect 6% in 18 of the 35 districts, then you only have to go to 3 of the urban areas in the state of Idaho, and you don't have to collect signatures in the rural areas. So I was supportive of the idea of increasing that, just because to acknowledge the change in population in the state of Idaho and in the urban centers. So I would have been comfortable raising that to, I'd say maybe 22, 24, 26 districts, but I didn't agree with going to the full 35 of 35 districts, and so I voted no on that. Mm-hmm. I think it's important to acknowledge, too, that Senate Bill 1110 passed by both bodies, signed by the governor, and put in law, but also being challenged in court right now in the Idaho State Supreme Court.
Yeah, there are some of those that are contending that it kind of opposes the fact that our Constitution provides for initiative process, and this is making it so difficult that it will make initiatives almost impossible. Okay, that's that one. There were several bills that were limiting the governor's emergency powers this year. Walk us through what those were and the ones that did actually get passed. And we really only have a few minutes left, so.
Okay. Yeah. But I think the quick summary is we had a Senate Bill 1136 and a House Bill 135. Senate Bill 1136 and House Bill 135 both passed by the bodies and both vetoed by the governor. Senate Bill 1136, I did then, between the time we originally voted on it and when we came back for the veto override, I had conversations as well as other senators that with the director of the Office of Emergency Management and the Idaho Adjutant General, and there were some concerns about ability to respond and the timelines on that. So 1136 was not, the veto was not overridden in the Senate. The result was a process of people going back from the legislative branch and the executive branch, looking at what needed to be changed in that Senate bill. 1217 was the result. I think I got that number right. Yes, 1217. And Senate Bill 1217 is now signed into law and in effect. So the veto, it was a painful process to go through, but the changes were made. And then the other one, House Bill 135, same thing. House Bill 135 vetoed, not overridden. The result was House Bill 391, 392, and 393. All those can be seen at the website, the legislative website, which is legislature.idaho.gov. But the quick pieces on Senate Bill 1217, the legislature does have to be called back into session to continue an emergency beyond 90 days. But that emergency has to be in 12 or more counties. And Senate bill, the original one that was vetoed, only required an emergency in one county. And there was a question about, do you call the whole legislature in for something that happens in one county? And then 60 days versus 90 days. So we ended up with a bill that has a mechanism to call the legislature back in after 90 days of an emergency in 12 or more counties. House bill, that three House bills, really, the 391 prohibits any limitation on firearms or the right to peaceable assembly or free exercise of religion during a state of disaster emergency. House Bill 392 prohibits the executive branch from altering, adjusting, or creating any provision of Idaho law. And House Bill 393 essentially recognizes anybody who has a job is an essential worker. It prohibits unnecessary restrictions on the ability of a person to work or provide for their family. So those were the contested points that really came about because we have some code that was written in the 1960s and 70s and had not gone through a pandemic yet. And so those were the changes that were made.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that goes to basically the, you know, separation of powers between the different branches of government and making some adjustments there, I guess you could say.
Yes.
And believe it or not, Jim Woodward, State Senator for District 1. We are out of time. I do want to swing back to the question I posed at the start. So all in all, sum it up with, you know, do you think the legislature had a decently productive year? What grade would you give it, the session we just ended?
Well, I'd probably give it a better grade for the outcomes, but a pretty poor grade for the process in which it happened. I was frustrated in some ways, but that is politics, I suppose.
Mm, yeah. Well, we have a ton more to talk about. We're going to have to get you back on to do that because we are trying to get additional interviews in this hour with Sage Dixon and Heather Scott. So we have to wrap it up, but I want to say thanks again, Senator Woodward, for speaking with us.
Yeah, thank you, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity always.
We're speaking now with our first district House Representative, Sage Dixon. Sage, thank you for taking time to talk with us today.
Well, it's always a pleasure, Chris. I appreciate the opportunity that you afford all of us to speak to our constituents.
Well, this year, the Idaho legislature was quite a thing to observe from the distance anyways, and it actually made some history. It's the longest session that the legislature's ever had. And right now, as I understand it, the House is actually just in recess while the Senate has adjourned. Really briefly, what does that mean?
Well, that means that we could technically call ourselves back into session. If we had adjourned fully like the Senate, or sine die is the term we use, the Latin term, then we couldn't go back into session. It would take the next legislative session unless the governor were to call us back like he did last summer. But this allows us to go back if there's something we feel we need to address. And I thought that was a viable option for us to keep open. The Senate obviously didn't agree in sine dying, but with our rules the way they are between the two bodies, if we decided to go back into session, the Senate would have 3 days to reconvene itself. They would have to come back within 3 days.
Okay, and we'll probably get in, and when we talk about some of these bills, about why you might want to be able to call yourself back into session. But let's back up a little bit and give us your take on the legislative session in general. Do you think it was a good, productive session? And a question you can answer now or when we wrap up, what grade would you give the legislature this year if you were handing out grades?
I'd have to claim the fifth on that one. you know, there was a lot going on this session. It was a very difficult session. Initially, just trying to deal with some of the outfall of the COVID crisis and how the executive branch handled that and wanting to make some corrections there. And then we did have a historical event in a public ethics hearing for the first time, and then just working through a lot of different things. But in the end, I think what came out of it was very productive in the end. So it was trying for me. I took on way too much personally as well. In addition to my committee chairmanships, I had five or six pieces of legislation I was trying to run. So I was extremely busy. But when I step back from it, now that I've been home for a week or two here, I do think it was productive, that we did get some good things done.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, let's. You mentioned a public ethics hearing. That had to do with a specific legislator and his conduct, right?
Yes, it did.
Yeah, so we don't really need to get into that. I don't think it really involved you in any way. Were you part of the hearing?
I was the chairman of the committee, Chris. So
it involved you. Okay, I wasn't following that.
No, we don't have to talk about that. But that just was an added stress to everybody in the House and a little bit in the legislature because it was just a House hearing. But that was an additional stress on top of everything else that was going on this session.
And I just don't want to leave people too mystified. It had to do with a legislator and his conduct towards an intern or a staffer?
Correct, yes. Yeah. She was a legislative intern.
Yeah.
And there was conduct that the committee felt was unbecoming of a legislator. And that's what our determination is. It's not a legal decision. It's not a criminal trial. It is this something that reflects well upon the legislature? And it is another legislator that brings that charge to the committee. And the committee felt it was, and that it needed to proceed to the public hearing, and that was the first time that's ever happened. So that was a bit unique, and again, it's an added difficulty.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's get into what you thought were some of the most important bills that the legislature dealt with this year, and what your take on those were.
I think in trying to reestablish or more clearly define the separation of powers when it comes to emergency orders, and that's what many of us went down there to try and correct, and that was the big battle that kept going on between the House and Senate and then the legislature and the governor, and what does this look like going forward to address a statewide emergency order. The prior emergency orders are localized, and there was never an issue with that, and we had one about a month ago with the windstorms or so, a little bit, maybe it was more than a month, but we declared a state of emergency in order for the locals to access funds from the federal government to become available. And that's a necessary thing to help the local governments take care of problems and to allow National Guard to come out and things like that. So there was never really a problem with the emergency declaration prior to what we experienced in COVID when it became statewide and it became re-upping it every few weeks, whenever it would expire, I forget the time limit average. I think it was 30 or 60 days, and he re-upped it for another 45 or something like that. But it just seemed to be this perpetual thing that it wasn't really intended to be, but it wasn't clear that the legislature had any role in trying to help mitigate that. So to me, it was important to make that more clear, establish those lines clearly, and that we would have the opportunity as the legislature to address the concerns of our constituents rather than just something being put on the state as a blanket, as it were. Our situation up in the north was quite different than it was in the southern part of the state, and especially, say, in Blaine County, where the real hot spot was. And many of us in these outlying areas felt we should have been treated differently. So this was an opportunity to reassert that. That was what a lot of the battle was through most of the session, and it took until the last couple of days, really, for that to shake out. The governor vetoed the two bills that were passed by both the House and the Senate, and then conversation started again where the governor was a little more open to hearing some different ways to approach this, and this another bill popped out of the Senate at the end that was a good bill. It wasn't exactly what the House was asking for in the beginning, but it addressed a lot of our concerns, and it was a good compromise bill to come out. So. And then they took what the House bill was and broke it up into three separate bills to address other things, and the governor went ahead and signed those as they passed. So that was probably the most important thing in my mind. I think if there's a positive in the pandemic, it is that this exposed a deficiency that was there in the structure of government that we never really had to deal with. And so now it's stronger, and the citizens of Idaho will be able to be represented by their elected folks rather than just having something blanket put upon them.
Mm-hmm. And just to clarify, so the bills that did pass, the governor did sign those?
Yes, both. I believe it was Senate Bill 1208, which limited the duration of an emergency order to 90 days without legislative approval. And then it was what was House Bill 135 was broken up into House Bills 401, 402, and 403, and those dealt with business as being essential, not abridging constitutional rights, and not the governor not being allowed to change existing law. He can change rules because that's under his purview in the executive branch, his now, whatever. I'm saying him, could be a woman in the future, but that's under the purview of the executive branch, so they can change rules, but they cannot change laws. And so that was what was clearly stipulated in those other three House bills, and he did sign all three of those.
Okay, so came to some agreement there, at least.
Yes.
Okay, other legislation you thought was important that came out of this session?
Well, we did very well revenue-wise through the pandemic because we took a much lighter touch, if you will, than our surrounding states. And so many people were coming here as a destination to escape lockdowns and whatnot, for better or worse, but that did help our economy. And then with the federal dollars that were coming in, people were spending it as intended to stimulate the economy. So we were flush with revenues, both, mainly sales tax revenues in doing that. And for many of us in the House, it's always an opportunity to take a look at our tax structure. And so we were working on tax relief. We have a growing what's called a taxpayer relief fund, and that is derived from the internet sales taxes, and that keeps growing pretty well. And then so in doing that, we went in and lowered our income tax rates by nearly 0.5%, and then lowered our corporate tax rate by nearly 0.5% as well. And we saw a large jump in our economy when we had done that a couple of years ago, and so I think that was a positive coming out of it. We're making use of existing funds. All the projections show that we by no means will have the revenue going forward that we had in 2020, but we're still going to be growing quite a bit in this state. I think that's well known. So these projections were based upon that, and it looked safe to go ahead and reduce those income tax rates. I thought that was a positive. And we did do a big transportation funding package, which is important for us up here. And Senator Woodward and myself have been able to battle with our colleagues down south and get some dollars up here. And Senator Keogh was wonderful at that as well and really taught me how to do that when I was new. I've sat on the Transportation Committee since I got in the legislature, so it's important to me that we get those dollars as well, and we've been able to. So this will give an additional $80 million into what's called the Transportation Expansion and Congestion Mitigation Fund. It's called TECM. But that goes directly to projects that need to help with all our congestion that we're experiencing with everybody moving into the state. And then it also gives new monies to the localities, and that's always a concern. We have our independent highway district. We have the county that's responsible for things, and those same situation scattered throughout the state. And they will be getting an additional 1.5% of sales tax revenue that will be distributed to the counties. So this year it's between 10 and 12 million, and as our economy keeps growing, those dollars will go up. The downside is, of course, if the economy contracts, they will get less, but it's new dollars that will constantly be going to the locals, which is helpful. The ITD part of it is capped at $80 million. So that's an additional 3% that goes into state roads, which is a good amount, but it's capped. Anything that's over that will go into the locals. So those are two good pieces of legislation, and we kept biting around the edges of property taxes, but I still think we need to do a lot of work on that. There's still a lot of unhappy people.
We see property values going up.
Right.
I think you'll probably hear more of that. You mentioned you had 5 or 6 pieces of legislation personally. Do you want to touch on that in just a few minutes?
Sure. A couple of them were specifically related to the business committee and some things that we had have encountered in there for a few years, and since I've been chairman of that committee, had to do with electrical apprenticeship ratios. The legislature was looking to make some changes there, and we were having kind of a battle with the electrical board that's appointed by the governor, and they are heavy in one direction. It's not really an appropriate representation of how the trade is throughout the state. So, long story short there, it was an effort to change the number of apprentices that are required per journeyman on the job. And it became a large battle. The union that is pretty strong in the southern part of the state with a lot of the mining down there and some of the large commercial projects. And they were pushing back, and we had conversations and tried to make it where they could accept something, but they didn't want to accept anything. And ultimately, the Senate told me, we're not going to hear your bill. So it came onto the docket in the House. I introduced it in the House Business Committee, but the chairman of the Senate had been talked to, and one of his members was really strongly against it as well, and they said they weren't going to hear it. We tried to broker some sort of a deal, but the deal was you do what the union wants or we're not doing anything. So that wasn't a battle I needed to fight this year, and it wasn't going to go anywhere. The chairman have that authority to hear a bill or not, so it wasn't something to keep pushing on. So that kind of died. There were a couple of years ago, the legislature passed a bill saying that locals could not exceed their building requirements from what the state sets, because there was kind of a patchwork of requirements going around, and it was difficult on builders, and it was driving up some prices in certain areas. But we saw that they were finding a way around it and stating that it's not under our building code, it's under the electrical code or the plumbing code. So I had some legislation drafted to say that it's every part of building, every trade, so electrical, plumbing, HVAC. What the state sets as the standard is the standard. They can't exceed that. But in trying to accommodate them, I was speaking with building officials, and specifically from Ada County, and they had some concerns about the way it was written. And we went back and forth, and that didn't really come out either. As this ethics committee issue came to the forefront, my time was taken by dealing with that for the most part, so I wasn't able to really push a lot of these bills. I did have a bill, I think we talked about it earlier, that would allow people to ranch reindeer north of the Salmon River.
Reindeer ranching, yeah.
Yes, that's right. We called the Reindeer Freedom Bill is what we joked about. They were prohibited north of the Salmon River, and the concern was that reindeer are essentially domesticated caribou. So when we had the caribou herd up there in the Selkirks running along the border, there was concern that they might crossbreed, or you could get disease crossing over, the same way with elk, and that concern is. But I had a couple gentlemen call me within 2 or 3 weeks of each other asking for the same thing, for that prohibition to be removed. And so those are fun things for me to do, something that directly affects my constituents. And so I went through with that. Senator Woodward carried it in the Senate. It was a really great learning experience. They still have to apply for a permit through the Department of Agriculture to prove that they have all the protections for disease going in, but at least now that prohibition is removed. So that was a fun one that went through. And then I had a bill relating to federalism and states' rights and how the state might react to certain government actions that appear to be outside of the scope of their constitutional authority. That went through the House pretty well, but the Senate didn't like it. They thought it looked like a nullification bill. I didn't have time to educate them on what my goal really was, and it's hard to do when you're there in front of the committee for the first time, and they're just reading something for the first time. So some of the language was a bit too strong for them, and they didn't like it. They held it in committee. I will try again next year with that one because I think it's important, and it's not just immediately important. There's been a long-term overreach, in my opinion, from the federal government coming into states. So it was an attempt to do that. I worked on child witness legislation. It's up to the court's discretion at this point whether a child can testify remotely, and it's pretty traumatic for children to be in front of somebody, especially if it's a family member that harmed them. And I believe Justice Julian up in Boundary County does not allow it. And so a lady that works with children up there contacted me, and I thought there was merit in that, and I was working on that. We were getting close, but the Supreme Court just had a ruling last December that more clearly defined what our statute said, and it's solely at the purview of the court. So I was not going to go anywhere, even if this legislation passed. It probably wouldn't go anywhere in the courts. And so working with our prosecutor here, Lewis Marshall, and another prosecutor down in Ada County, we're trying to find another route around that, or at least to give some protection to the child in that case, where the judge maybe has to reconsider, you know, an appeal to reconsider, because the defendant has that ability as well. If the judge allows it, he can appeal that decision. So at the very least, we were thinking maybe that the child should have that ability as well. But that's something I worked on. I did protection for parental rights under an emergency declaration. There was concerns that Child Protective Services could come into a home if you didn't protect your children sufficiently during COVID, and I thought there was some reason there to protect that. So that legislation did get passed and go through and was signed. So that's law. Whereas if there's emergency declaration, that doesn't mean that your parental rights are abridged. So the agencies can't just come in and say, well, we're under an emergency, we're taking your children. There was a lot of concern about that, and some of it may have been exaggerated, but again, I saw merit in installing that protection. And I think there's another couple. So it takes a lot of time to do that, Chris. And then as a chairman of a committee, people are coming to me with their legislation, asking what I think of it, and, well, I hear it in my committee. And so it was a fairly busy session. I took on too much. There's things I want to do as a legislator, but in my role as chairman, I need to keep that in mind to do that job well also, and the responsibility that goes with that. So I won't be going down with 5 bills again, I don't think.
Yeah. It's a lot to get a single bill passed. So
it is.
And I will say on the reindeer bill, there's already a fellow up here that's planning to get a reindeer ranch or a reindeer farm going.
Yes, he did it up in Alaska. And his first name's Michael. I couldn't remember his last name. I was speaking to the Kiwanis yesterday about that. It's a fun little story. And he was fantastic in coming down, and his knowledge of ranching them and the industry was very helpful in speaking to the agricultural committees, where I don't have that knowledge. I can give them what I can in my point of arguing it, but he had the in-depth knowledge of things that they're familiar with. So it was really nice to work with him and meet his family, and I think they should have that soon. And theirs is an educational perspective. The other gentleman, I think, was interested in ranching them for meat, because there is a potential there as well. But Mike likes to take the reindeer around to parties, and especially around Christmas, or have a petting zoo type thing, and just have people see something they're not used to seeing. There's a fascination with it, I think.
Especially around Christmas time, huh?
Yes.
So we don't have but a few minutes left. I did want to ask you about Senate Bill 1110, which raises the threshold for signatures required for initiatives. 6% of registered voters statewide previously had to be collected in at least 18 of the legislative districts, and the bill raises that to all 35 districts. Now, Reclaim Idaho, which had the last successful initiative a few years ago, and even former Supreme Court Chief Justice Jim Jones contend that this will basically make it impossible for citizens to get an initiative on the ballot to meet that threshold, and that's guaranteed by the Idaho Constitution. I know this is going to – actually, I think a lawsuit's already been initiated on this.
Yeah.
But what was your take on this, and what was your position on it?
Well, I was a co-sponsor in the House, so I was in favor of that. And my main reason why is because I think if we're going to be making law, then everybody in the state needs to have a voice in making that law. And it goes beyond just being able to vote for it. So this is what I originally pushed for 2 years ago when we first started having meetings, and the bill that I was a sponsor of in the House 2 years ago to change a little bit of the structure of how the ballot initiatives are approached. But the governor vetoed that one. But I believe strongly that it's going to go on the ballot before everybody in the state it's a lawmaking process, that everybody in the state should have some say in it through that proxy, which is the signature gathering effort. So I believe strongly in this. I think it's proper for our structure of government and how we make law, and I know the Supreme Court agreed to hear that lawsuit, so it's moving forward pretty quick. I don't know if that was just an initial hearing or if that's the full hearing, but that's going on, and there's also Reclaim Idaho has started a referendum effort, which will give people the ability to vote that law out of existence, essentially.
But they'll have to meet the new threshold with that. Is that right?
No, I believe that they already had started that process before the law goes into effect.
Okay.
We'll have to look at that. I'm not sure about that, Chris. You may be right. I don't recall if there was an emergency clause in that bill. If there was, then it went into effect as soon as the governor signed it. And that may be a small deficiency in that bill, because that wasn't the intent there. But, we'll see what happens, Chris. I think strongly in that lawmaking process and elected representation, because that pushes us in the direction of a direct democracy, and it really does silence the voice of people outside of the larger population centers, because if they put it on the ballot, then they're the ones that can vote for it as well, and they'll outvote everybody else. And that's one reason why I don't think it's a proper way of doing things as far as making law, but it is in our Constitution, and so if we're going to have that, it should be as just as possible, and that's what my efforts are in trying to straighten up that system, and it is part of the legislature's purview to do that. You know, it clearly says that we're the ones that will set the parameters of what that looks like. So,
well, one of the objections that the opponents raise is that actually what will happen is it'll shift the power to special interest groups that get a bunch of money from outside the state. And so the grassroots groups that can go around and get something on the ballot now, which doesn't happen very often, it's already a very difficult process, are going to be sidelined because the threshold is too high. But a group from outside of Idaho that has a ton of money to buy signature gatherers to go out to these different districts will be able to still utilize the initiative process. What would your response, pretty briefly, to that be?
Well, I'd want to clear that up as well, as opposed to bringing signature gatherers in, and that's the process that's used right now. Both the horse racing folks on that had their ballot initiative, which was, I think that was number one, and then the number two was the Medicaid expansion one. Both of them used outside money and outside signature gatherers to do that, so I don't think that's... It's a little bit of a fallacious argument. Since those were used before, it's not going to cause it to be used by strengthening the process a little bit on what it should look like. I think that does need to be tightened up as well. And if this is going to be something that the citizens of Idaho want or it's on the ballot for us to vote on, then it should be purely driven by Idaho, not outside interests. And I see outside interests are already here pushing things that the legislature is not going to vote for. The elected representatives of Idaho won't pass legislation, so outside interests are coming in and trying to use the ballot initiative process.
Okay, well, that one we're going to read more about because it's going to be pursued through the courts at this point.
Right.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens there. Sage Dixon, I hate to say it, we're out of time already.
I read too many bills. I talked too long about that.
Well, it's we didn't have enough time to start with, but we are going to circle back at some point before we get back into the next session for sure, maybe a time or two, and talk to you more about what happened in this session and plus, you know, what might be happening in the next legislative session. So, Representative Sage Dixon, thanks again for talking with us today.
Thanks, Chris. It's always a pleasure, and I appreciate the opportunity, as I always say. It's a good discussion. And you asked some good questions, so thank you.
We're talking now with our first district representative, Heather Scott. Heather, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thanks for having me on.
So the topic here is the legislative session, which just ended, and it was, in fact, the longest session in state history. How do you rate it? Do you think it was a good, productive session, or would you like to have seen them get more done?
Well, it always depends on who productive for who. I guess any time government's not interfering in our lives, I think it's productive. So any time there's some restraint on government, which seems like we were back and forth debating quite a bit, fighting quite a bit between the House and Senate, so that might have turned out well for the citizens for once.
I guess that's one way to look at it, isn't it?
Yes, it is. We did have 682 bills that were introduced, and of those, 386 passed, which is a lot of legislation.
That is a lot of legislation. Are those records, too? Do you know?
Are they records?
Record numbers for a session, number of bills introduced?
No, that's about normal. I mean, that's about normal.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Well, see, the legislators are busy down there. It's hard to tell sometimes when we're way up here in the north and a little bit removed from it. And the House is actually just in recess right now while the Senate adjourned. In our previous talks today with Senator Woodward and Representative Dixon, they explained how that works and that the House could call itself back into session this year if the right kind of issues pop up. So let's use our time to talk about some of the bills that passed that you think or were at least considered that you think your constituents up here should know about.
Okay, I'll just run through as quick as I can. I'll try to elaborate where I can. For tax relief, everybody wants income tax relief, but mostly property tax relief. and grocery tax relief. And I will start out by saying there was no grocery tax relief. With our current leadership, we will not get a repeal of the grocery tax. So hopefully maybe we can work on that in the future, but as of now, we're still paying grocery tax. We did have several competing bills for income tax and property tax reduction. Of course, the best one for the citizens did not, even though it had 50 co-sponsors, they would not give it a hearing in the House. So we got a watered down property tax relief and income tax relief. And I'll go into more detail on that if we have time at the end. But ultimately, you should see a slight decrease in your taxes because the homeowner's exemption was increased. It's slight. It is not a huge tax relief. Only about maybe $8 to $10 million of property tax cuts. So that was all you got for property tax. Now, a big debate this time was the balance of powers between the executive branch and the legislative branch. We watched over last year with the COVID 2020, and it was so frustrating to watch one person unilaterally make decisions for the state.
That being the governor, yeah.
Being the governor. Mm-hmm. And the legislature hemmed and hawed if we could call ourselves back in or if we couldn't. Well, we did, we were promised these five bills first day of session. If we would just get on board with these five bills, they were veto-proof through the House and Senate, and we would rein in the governor's emergency control powers. That was kind of not really true. The leadership of the House and Senate, I'm somewhat suspicious they may have been working with the governor, because those bills did nothing to rein him in, and actually in some cases expanded some of his powers. And so that was a big conversation all throughout the session. It pretty much dominated the session. We came up with bills and language, passed it through the House, passed it through the Senate, the governor vetoed it. The House would override something, the Senate would not override it. And sometimes it's hard to stand up to the governor because, you don't want him to veto your own bills when you have them in front. So people get chicken kind of after he vetoes something and don't stand as strong. Finally, the very last week of session, we got a couple bills that basically, just the gist of them, one says that the governor cannot change Idaho laws during an emergency. And that is something he did. He changed our election laws. He changed, I think, 57 rules. Another one says it protects the Idahoans' rights to where you can't call people essential and non-essential, or businesses essential and non-essential. And it limits how long he can actually declare an emergency for. So those were definitely wins for the people, for more balance of power. Not as strong as we all would like, but to just let one person make decisions during a time of trouble can be dangerous, as we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Let's go to education. Education was, it was a big battle this year because there's a lot of money. We knew there was a lot of money coming through, and we kept asking our caucus and our leadership, we want to address this critical race theory that's being taught in the schools, in the colleges. They would not let us work on language for that, any policy. So by the time all the funding came through, we showed them just how serious we were in the House by killing their bills. We started with killing a teacher's salary and a college funding bill. And of course, the headlines probably up north said, Republicans hate teachers and hate colleges and higher education. That's not really the case. What was going on behind the scenes is we were trying to get good policy in place that they would not let us get in place. So once they saw we were serious on stopping this agenda through our schools, we got the policy passed. We came back through and funded the schools and colleges.
Heather, tell us what's your definition of critical race theory? Because I've seen it defined in different ways.
Well, what critical race theory is, it basically demands that everything in society be viewed through the lens of like racism, sexism, and power. It attacks, everyone is judged on the color of your skin, not how hard you work or your actions. And the premise behind it is if you are a racial minority, you are a victim. And the system is rigged against you, no matter if it's the school system, if it's your job, whatever. And if you're a majority race, which Chris, you would be because you're a male, white male, you are an oppressor. And the whole thought behind this is there's racism, and it occurs everywhere throughout society, and we have to get equal outcomes. And so just a quick example, if you owned a store and a white person and a black person came in at the exact same time, if you wait on the white person first, you're racist because you think the white person is more important than the black person. If you wait on the black person first, you are waiting on him because you think he's trying to rob you. It is a lose-lose situation. And so that is the lens that they look through everything through. And you know, we interviewed college students and high school students sent in examples. And we, first day of an engineering class, the white men in that class are told to write how they are privileged for being a white male in society and how that's going to affect how they're going to act differently in the future to not oppress racial minorities.
And was this at college students?
That was BYU, a 300-level class. So it's going on everywhere. That's just one example of hundreds and hundreds of examples that came forward. So that is what we're trying. We do not want racism and sexism in our schools. We want people to be judged on the quality of their work and their performance, not on their skin color. And that's a problem when we say skin color is what defines you and who you are. And so that's what we were trying to stop.
And what was the policy? How's that going to be applied in the schools?
It basically says that it prohibits them from promoting social justice programming and being an advocacy for critical race theory in our schools and our universities. It's a start. I wouldn't say it's the perfect bill, but it basically says you cannot do this. It puts it into policy that you can't treat people different based on their skin color. I mean, it seems crazy that we would have to put this into our law, but we do. So, because this is what they're doing in our colleges, they're starting to give grants for, it's just the whole system is now almost flopped to where it is showing preferential treatment to any minority over performance, and that's a problem. Does that make sense?
Well, it does, but I'm not well-versed enough on this issue to really bring up what might be the other argument here, which is, you know, there is systemic racism that it expresses itself and somehow in different ways in our society. And we really don't have enough time to dig in on this. Would be a whole conversation unto itself, I think.
Probably be a good show.
How is that tied to the actual education budget?
So that's my point, is because we could not get policy to stop this, it's coming through the funding. So the federal funding comes with strings attached. And that is one of the priorities of the Biden administration, to push this critical race theory in the schools. And so I don't have that in front of me, the project, but that being said, we do not want to judge people based on their color. That is just not right. And so that's the only way we could get the policy in place, is to hold those funding until we got the policy in place and then say, okay, now we'll fund it. So everything got funded. I think the schools, the colleges maybe got bumped down about 2.8 million, but they received 160 million from the feds to put this stuff in place. So the colleges are flush with cash. I could go through, I think of the highest 250 paid employees in the state, almost 190 of them are college employees. So there's a lot tied to it, but that's kind of a 80,000 foot view, if that makes sense.
So basically, sounds like the legislature withheld about 2.8 million, you said, from college funding in order to send kind of a warning shot across the bow here for the...
No, we held the bills to do the warning shot. We just said, we're not going to pass any money until you give us policy. So once we got the policy, we fully funded the schools, and then we bumped the colleges down about 2.8, because we found so many places where this has already been implemented in the colleges. I mean, they've built buildings. I don't know if you followed what's going on at BSU. It's crazy how extreme it has become in these colleges, and really the reverse racism against white people. And so I think it brought attention to it. The 2.8 was just kind of a slap on the wrist, I think. But overall, I mean, they got their money. Mm-hmm. And what we didn't give them, they're getting from the feds. Mm-hmm.
Well, let's turn to another aspect of education funding. There was a $6 million, I think, federal grant that was on the table for preschool funding. And there was legislation relating to that. Why don't you tell us about that one?
So that was also giving money to a preschool grant. It was putting a $1 million of that $1 million of that $6 million into, they say preschool grant, but what most people don't realize is that's not preschools. It's kids age 0 to 5, which Idaho's made it pretty clear in their policy. They don't fund the preschools. They do Head Start stuff, but they do not have preschool. But so anyway, $1 million was going to preschool, but the other $5 million was actually going to a bureaucracy they were creating around them, which were pushing and promoting the critical race theory and also data collection on these kids. And so that's why that bill did not pass. And if you get my newsletter, you probably saw some of the examples of the books that they were pushing for these age 0 to 5 year olds. But the bottom line is all that money was being given to one nonprofit in our state who was going to distribute it out to who they thought were worthy of that money. And so that's just not a good way to be divvying out money in our state. We had plenty of cash if we wanted to get money to preschool kids without all these strings attached. We had an extra $6 million. We had an extra $600 million. So they made a big deal of this, but this is just more ideology coming into our state. And you can see examples of those books on my old newsletter. It was pretty bad. So that's why we did not pass that bill.
You mentioned your newsletter. How do people get on your newsletter list?
if you go to the legislative website and look up House members, you can click and sign up for my newsletters on that site. It's just idaholegislature.gov, then look under the House members, and you'd have to find my name, and there's a thing that says sign up for newsletters, and you can sign up right there.
Okay. We, believe it or not, we only have a few minutes left. I know.
Don't say
crazy.
That.
Because there's so much that goes on, and I know. Why don't you...
go ahead.
Well, you go ahead, Heather. You had a couple more that you I know you wanted to talk about.
Well, we did do a lot of election integrity bills. We ended up passing a Second Amendment bill, the Firearms and Firearms Accessory and Components Protection Act.
Tell us a little bit about that one. What does that accomplish?
Let's see what it says. It does not let the state cooperate with the feds for gun issues. I'm just trying to read my notes here. Well, I'm sorry you've asked me that because it's basically setting it up so we could take them to court if they try to confiscate guns. Not only guns are essential for Idahoans, but it also says that accessories and components are necessary for Idahoans. It prohibits elected officials from Idaho officials from being ordered to enforce federal actions that are contrary to the Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big bill, a big win for the Second Amendment. We had lots of bills on elections. Your listeners probably are aware of the initiative bill and what that did. It's still the 6%, but instead of 18 legislative districts having to get the signatures, it says all legislative districts have to get the signatures to put something on the ballot.
Have to
so
get that 6%.
You have to get the 6%. So that basically... Because right now they could have basically just done Ada County and Twin Falls area and got something on the ballot. And the rural areas a lot of time are left out. So I'll hit a few more. There was a hemp bill
Let me ask you another question because I'm familiar with that one.
Okay.
So the Reclaim Idaho group plus former Chief Justice Jim Jones, they were both critical of that bill because they say it's basically going to make it impossible for a grassroots group to collect those signatures, and it'll actually bias that process to, well-funded and often out-of-state interests that have the money to pay signature gatherers. What would your response to that be, that it's just simply going to make it kind of impossible for citizens to get initiatives passed?
Yeah, I don't think it's impossible. Jim Jones is full of himself, and I don't even want to go into a conversation on him. But in my opinion, he should be living in, like, North Korea or China or somewhere that fits more with his politics. So I don't really respond to what he thinks about what we do. But that was passed by 56 votes in the House. I mean, it was a complete party line vote. I understand that there's Democrats in North Idaho too, and I get that. But this bill was really a fair bill, unlike what they tried to do last year, which I didn't agree with. And as you remember, I voted opposite of the party last year. This bill was fair for all districts, and I'm looking out for the entire district. So it doesn't make it impossible.
Okay.
So that's kind of...
You mentioned a couple other that earlier when we were talking before the show.
Yes.
There was a hemp bill that was passed. Yes.
Yep. Hemp, you can grow hemp. I would advise you to talk to the Farm Bureau on that. It's a very highly regulated crop to grow, and it was a big police state bill. I would say it's heavily, you just need to be careful growing hemp. There was a wolf bill that seemed to be somewhat controversial to try to address the wolf population in the state. That was that was a compromise bill with ranchers, farmers, sportsmen's group. I know a lot of people were really upset about that bill, but there was a lot of discussions and collaborations with that bill. So that was a bill.
That raised the number of wolves that can be taken.
Yes.
Each year, yeah.
Yes. We did pass a bill that raises the out-of-state fees for state parks. And I think I talked about that on your last show. So, like, if you're coming from out-of-state and you're going to come into Idaho State Parks, you're going to pay double. Because Idahoans need to be able to enjoy their parks, and they're full of Washington people up here. So even though that's one bill I voted for that I was like, yeah, I know it's kind of raising the rates, but it's raising it on the out-of-staters that are coming and using all our resources. Mm-hmm. So that's a state parks thing. Water credits for pollution, cloud seeding or chemtrails. I'll go into detail on a lot of these on my year-end update. So if you sign up in the next week, I probably will get that out in the next 2 weeks. You will get all the updates on that. One thing I wanted to mention really quick is Greater Idaho. You know, that's the Move Idaho's Border initiative, and they are working hard. They were serious. They presented to our House and Senate Environment Committees. I mean, there's a lot of people in Oregon that want to join Idaho, and they are passing it on their ballots, on their county elections. I wanted to mention one other thing. You know, we have, there's been the issue of trying to pull out the dams and what's happening across the state.
The Snake River dams.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that is all tied together with Idaho National Labs, Bill Gates. There's a big connection there with nuclear power and our dams. And so kind of keep that in mind when you make your decisions or start researching. Look into nuclear, because Bill Gates is definitely working with INL through Tierra Power. He is working on small nuclear reactors, and ultimately those are what they want to replace the dams with. And so just something to keep in mind when you're looking into government and what's happening. There's always more behind the scenes than you really know. There's so many more bills.
There's much more than we can cover, and I hate to say it, Representative Heather Scott, we have reached the end of our time, but if folks want to get more on everything you talked about and more, they can go to the legislature.idaho.gov website and click on House and then find you there, and they can get your newsletter there, as you mentioned.
Yes. Thank you for having me on.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Scott.